Welcome everyone, this is Chris Deasy. My guest this week is Haida Kunzelmann. Now, Haida is a former colleague of mine at the University of Kent. She is a German culture and language coach for international knowledge workers. So she's working with qualified migrants and expats. Now, she left Kent in 2020, and she talks about the transferable skills that she has accumulated and how she has used them to make a living. Haida talks about being a typical Austrian with a family who descend from many other cultures. And Haida talks about memories that stretch back to moving house at the age of four. She remembers a home with no electricity. She recalls talking to her new neighbours, the many things that she was able to do as an only child. Haida talks about the importance of her Walkman and how she would take long walks and listen to Rick Astley. We talk about the notion of instant gratification, of retro, the role of nostalgia, how film can be a portal into our pasts that opens up an emotional landscape. Haida talks about the relationship between the uncanny and nostalgia. And Haida talks about why Top Gun was the coolest film ever when she was growing up. Things that matter to us now, we are bound to think differently about when we are our parents' age. Haida studied German and English at university. She wanted to be a musician. We learn why that dream didn't really come about. Haida is doing many of the same things her mother did, and she talks about the influence of both her parents in her life. Towards the end of the interview, Haida talks about why nostalgia can be like a drug and why we glorify the past. She talks about how her younger self wanted to work on an English university campus, and we learn about the novelette she wrote when she was 16. And at the very end of the interview, Haida explains why she is a looking forward kind of person. It was an immense privilege for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to catch up with Haida Kunzelmann. My name is Chris Deasy. So it is fantastic to catch up once again with a former colleague here at the University of Kent, Haida Kunzelmann. And it's actually wonderful, Haida, to see you, because we're doing this interview over Zoom, but we used to be neighbours. In fact, you were in the office directly behind where I am now.
That's right. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's really nice to be back, and really nice to be seeing the back wall of your office, which lets me see my former office.
And because you're now in Austria.
I'm in Vienna. Yes, I am. As you will have probably seen, I don't know whether you've seen it or not, but I'm now a language and culture coach for highly qualified migrants, highly qualified expats. Yes. So I've changed my career completely. Yeah. I'm doing something new.
And we were just saying before we started the recording that, of course, this all changed because of lockdown, or certainly before lockdown. You know, nobody quite knew where we would all end up a few years down the line. But so this has all been something that certainly has happened to you since we last had a conversation.
Yeah, well, that would have been, I think now it's 3 years ago. No, it can't be 2 or 3 years ago. We've been here since 2020. It all changed. The change started much earlier, obviously, and thinking about returning to where I set out originally, that started earlier, that happened earlier. But changing my career completely, that was a new thing in 2018. That developed over that summer when I knew that I'd be going back. Yeah. And I'm trying to make a living. It's all coming together. It's 2 years now since I've started this. I'm in the middle of the second year, and certainly it certainly looks different from where I've started, because what I wanted, I didn't know really what I could do as an academic, how to use my transferable skills. You know, I was quite aware of them, because we all are, because we have to talk about them a lot, but I didn't know really how to use them to make a living. And that now looks a little bit different. I have found a path that I'm pursuing, and it's fun. It's good.
Because when I knew you at Kent, of course, obviously you were lecturing in German, but you were also the senior tutor, a job that I did before you. But do you, what you said about transferable skills is really interesting, because I've often found that there are things that we can do that we don't know that we're doing them until we find ourselves sometimes in an environment outside the sector, when suddenly you realize that things like presentations, you know, students sometimes probably would rather not do them, but they will often say then afterwards that because they had to do a presentation in a module for those, you know, 10 minutes, one Tuesday morning, whatever it might've been, that that's helped them with a job interview. Absolutely. A few months or years down the line.
I mean, transferable skills have such a ring. If you're an academic, if you're working in the academic environment, it's something that you have to think about, you're forced to think about, and you almost, you know, deem somehow a ridiculous add-on or even a chore to think about. I always thought it was a little immodest to talk about all the things that you do on top of teaching and research, things that you're good at, like, you know, working with people, listening to people. These are all skills that are actually very useful and sought after out there. And once you have to start making money, you look at yourself and your story differently. Yeah. And of course, everybody is all about telling their own stories. So I've looked at my story and I realized that there are aspects in it that I can really use, because I can use them to help other people. I've done that as an academic in my work at uni, and I'm still doing it. So it's essentially everything I do is grouped around the aspect of trying to help somebody arrive in a different culture.
And I'm just thinking, because obviously you're to an extent back where you started, in the sense that obviously you are Austrian, and actually maybe that would be a great way to do a bit of delving there, because obviously, yeah. So you are Austrian, and obviously our paths crossed for a number of years in Canterbury at the University of Kent. But do you want to say just a little bit about your background, exactly where you're from?
Of course, yes. So I am a typical Austrian with family members who live in Croatia, who lived in Slovenia, who lived all over the place. So if you are an Austrian, you are properly a mixture of many influences. And my family, my mother's side is Croatian. So I've always had that aspect of having, it's not a migrant's background, because they all were Austrian, but I have a background with a different culture through my mother. And my father's family were Austrian back to the, it was in the 19th century, early 19th century, when they moved from Czernowitz, which is now in the Ukraine, where they were part of the German-speaking population there. So in that sense, I'm typically Austrian, because I have people coming to the Austrian heartland from you know, all sorts of places. I grew up in Graz and in Carinthia. I've moved from a town, a city, the second biggest city actually, age 4, to the countryside. And this is where I lived until I was 18, and then left home to study. And I've not returned back, but I'm going there to see family, of course, to see my parents.
And I just think, are there any particular earliest memories that you have? That, because I always find this, you know, that sort of, I mean, I do lots of reunions, and it took me many years to get to that stage in my life where I felt ready, or feeling that I was sufficiently, you know, at a place in my life where it was okay to start, you know, drawing up and, you know, revisiting literally both, you know, places and people from childhood. But often, of course, they carry with you, and sometimes I look in the mirror sometimes, and you sometimes forget that, you know, in my case, I'm in my late 40s, but, you know, there's obviously there's a part of me that still feels I'm, you know, 16 again or whatever, depending on the particular, what I'm listening to, or particular memories or thoughts or people I'm interacting with. And so are there any particular memories that you recall from growing up?
I can totally relate to that. I think when we think back, we go, some memories go way back to when you were really little, like 4 or 5. I do remember, for example, when we had moved, and nobody, it was the last house in the street. There was, after that, after my parents, it was not a finished house. My parents didn't have the money then to buy a complete bungalows, so it was still a building site in some bits. And we would move there, and my dad was in training, had to go to Vienna for weeks. So my mom and me were alone out there. There was no electricity, not yet. That was an end, late 70s. And we didn't know anyone. And I started touring the village. I was four at the time. I started touring the village and started talking to all the neighbors. And they'd always been friendly to us, you know. We were new. We were from the city. We were strangers in villages. Sometimes it's, you know, a very close and tight-knit community. And if you're new, you're new, and you stay new. In Austria, at least, I'm not sure about England, but I think, or the UK, but I think it's often the case that when you move somewhere, you're still the new people after 40 years. And my parents have lived there for 40 years now. So I toured and I met the neighbors that we had for the first time, and they got talking to my mother through me. And I remember talking to them. I thought they were friendly, all right, to me. That was fine. And my mom later said, through me, she actually had a chance to meet somebody else there, which I thought was nice. So yeah, I remember the woods. I remember the woodland and the rivers and the fields and the quiet. It was really, really quiet and relatively remote without a car. Although it's not that far away from the city, yeah. But that's an early memory.
Yeah, because I always find that when you meet people, when you're really young and you're a child, and then you meet those same people decades later, that it's very difficult to quite know how to navigate it, because your relationship with that person is, yeah. You know, you're the child, they're the adult. And then suddenly you're the person who's, you know, doing whatever you might be doing in life. But there is still a part of you that still feels that sort of hierarchical relationship still in place. And I find that quite, it's both funny, but also really, you know, discombobulating.
It is. It can be, but it can also be very reassuring, I think, because we do have our neighbors, that very neighbor, one of them who I'd met, was one of the first people I met when I was four. She still does her rounds every Christmas, and she is a Catholic country, so she picks up the flame from Jerusalem that's sent, you know, the peace flame that's sent to all the train stations all over Europe, and it travels. They light it in Jerusalem, and then they let it travel, and you can pick it up at the train station with a candle and then walk around. And she does that every year. She still comes to our house, and even during the pandemic, she delivers that flame. So I get to see her every year because I'm there for Christmas usually. And I'm again that little girl. And she has, you know, she'll talk to me as if I was still that neighborhood, as if I'd never left. And I had been away, and I have been away all in all for almost 20 years.
Yeah, but because it sounds as though it was obviously very quiet then when you were growing up, but you remember it's very much what you were describing there is very much the environment, and very peaceful, I think, was the word that you actually used.
It was totally, yeah, absolutely. Very, very sheltered, late 70s, early 80s. Lots to do for a child, even on my own. I loved being outside. I had a dog afterwards. That was because I'm an only child, so that was my sister, and she had to endure everything with me. But it was a lovely place to grow up with, and I like going back there, of course. Of course, it has changed. But
are there particular things that you remember doing? Because I mean, these days will, now that I can drive, and you know, so often I can go to the cinema if I want to. But when you were growing up, were there things like that, or perhaps around music or reading? Because obviously academia was something that beckoned. So, but are there particular things that you really enjoyed doing when you were young?
You'd be surprised. I did have my Walkman, and that was the most important technical gadget there was, and I would take long walks and listen to, I probably shouldn't say that, but, you know, the type of music I listened to, because I was in the mid-end 80s, I was 12, 13. So you really listen to the the most romantic songs that you can think of, and they're all incredibly kitschy. But I loved my Eros Ramazzotti, because we live close to the borders of Italy, my Eros Ramazzotti cassette. And you could only listen to one cassette at the time, so there was no skipping songs. There were no lists unless you made them yourself, as you know, the mixtapes. So I would listen to the few cassettes I had. I think Rick, this is really you have to cut this. Rick Astley was my first cassette I bought myself, and I listened to the whole thing up and down. So. Yeah.
Do you know, I've got stuff that I recorded, like even like early 80s, and the same as you. I used to record stuff off the radio at the charts on a Sunday. Yeah. And then for years afterwards, you know, I'd still be listening to that same time. But of course, yeah, you could fast forward, but really it made sense sometimes just to listen to it in its entirety. And so I think that that's a really good skill, because I wonder if that's why these days I'm always keen to see something, say, at the cinema rather than at home, because of course you haven't got that fast forward facility. You know, once you've committed to something, you have to see it all the way through. I'm not, you know, for me, channel hopping is something that is, you know, really just too scatty. It's like, you know, sometimes sit through it, and even if you don't like it, well, you know, that you've got something to learn from that experience, rather than give up before you've had a chance to, you know, for the attention span, you know, to, you know,
absolutely, and instant gratification. I think it does it trains you not to get that instant gratification, because you have the authority, the power to, and the ability to jump and skip what you don't want to hear, what you're bored by. But you don't get to look forward to things that much. I still remember the entirety of an album. That's something that I sometimes feel is lost when we, even now that our CDs are decoration, this is lost, because you don't put the CD in and then you wait and you know that track three is something that you really like and track two needs to be sat through. Yeah. That's a shame, I think, to a certain degree. So I remember long afternoons just walking around and singing along terribly, but there was no one to contribute to my...
But it's funny, isn't it? Because I used to feel, and even when I came to Kent, I didn't necessarily feel comfortable telling people that, because I listened to exactly the same stuff you mentioned, Rick Astley. But I always thought at the time, oh, people might think, you know, some of the older, because I was in my early 30s when I started working here, and my colleagues 30 or more years older than me. And so I sort of kept that a little bit quiet. But then there's a point when suddenly you realize that, you know, your generation, you know, my generation were the ones in the ascendancy. And we all listened to that sort of music. But of course, now from our students' point of view, that stuff is like really they haven't heard of, or it feels really sort of archaic. So it's almost as though you went from feeling that people might look down on you because you're listening to stuff that's your generation, not theirs. Then you realize that actually this is, you know, that you know, who cares? You know, who, and also Rick Astley as well, let's be honest. What a revival. I mean, he's, you know, in the last few years, you know, Never Gonna Give You Up, all these memes that sort of appear. So that stuff that might have seemed to be perhaps a bit kitsch in its day has, like ABBA were, you know, they went through a period perhaps of people were perhaps in the late 80s, early 90s, they're a bit out of fashion. Then suddenly they came back with a vengeance. So actually I think that the stuff that you might, you know, once upon a time might have been something that you wouldn't necessarily want to go and boast about, actually becomes like a completely, it's the zeitgeist, it completely sums up a particular era. Exactly.
And if it's samplable, if you can make it into a sample, I think it has stood the test of time. Yeah. When I thought about what we would be talking about, you know, I thought we are actually, or I am definitely, but you probably are, we are retro. We certainly are. And everything that I thought was crass and probably ugly at that point, the 80s with their neon colors, it now actually creates that nostalgic feeling. I mean, if I see somebody outside trying to dress like a person in the 80s, I think that it's still not the kind of fashion that I enjoy a lot wearing. But that makes me feel nostalgic, because that was a time when we were when we were teenagers, maybe at the beginning or the end, and thought there is something new and there is future, and this is where we're going. And you didn't know anything about anything. And now it makes you feel nostalgic because you know what came after that, and you know that naivety at that point was a blessing, a lovely feeling to be able to have, even though you didn't know it.
And that's the thing about memories, isn't it? Because at the time that you're going through something, you can't imagine what in 5 or 10 years' time people will be doing. But then, obviously, in 5 or 10 years' time, you look back and think, actually, things weren't so bad then at the time. You know, I mentioned that the fashions and so on. But also, something I found, and this is where technology can really help, is when you watch something, it could be a film, but something from that era, like from the 80s, but you watch it now in such pristine quality on, you know, either streaming it or in 4K or on Blu-ray or whatever, or even at the cinema sometimes. And you can, I saw The Godfather Part 2 only last night, and it looked, you know, it was magnificent to watch. And almost so good in places that it almost looks like it could be a film made now, but set in that era, because it just looks so incredibly, you know, real. You know, the quality is sublime. And I think sometimes that you mentioned nostalgia and retro, that is something that really makes a difference, because you're like, you're not just watching something again, you're watching it through a new lens. And you can never get away from the fact that, you know, it is 30 or 40 years on from when that happened. And I think sometimes you have that ability sometimes to say, you know, what was my first apprehension of this song or of this film? And you are able perhaps to look back and just see things through a different sort of lens. And it makes you, and I find this along the way, you think about not just obviously about the film or the music, but the people you watched it with. And you're wondering, where are they now? And there's that journey. So the film is part of, is not just a product in and of itself.
It is a portal, as are little motives, musical motives in film music, in a score. You just hear the motive and you're back there. I mean, that's memory, obviously. That's we've studied it, and we've studied the nature of memory in all our disciplines, I think, to a great degree. Smells, obviously, Proustian smells, sounds, colors, if they all come together synesthetically, that puts you back there, and it just kicks something off that probably doesn't have anything to do with the film anymore. It's just a kind of emotional landscape that's suddenly open to you again. And that's what music, film, and
it's kind of quality proof, because it's not relevant to sort of say, you know, is this good or bad? It's like, well, it's so much part of your DNA that you don't have that same sort of, you know, critical nexus. I mean, it's funny, because I'm now at a stage where I've almost like turned into my parents, because when I was in the early 80s, when I was the age that my children are now, my parents would often say, oh, well, look, turn it down. It's not as good as it was when we were young. And I was like, oh, come on. But now I've got like zero interest in the music that perhaps my children are really interested in. And I suddenly think, hang on, how did that happen? You know, I was the person who always, you know, and I've realized my enjoyment of, say, the charts is still there, but it's not so much the charts of now, but the charts of 30, 40 years ago. So it's like something is stuck in time.
Of course it is. And you know, I think we talked about it before. We talked about Mark Fisher, because that was the book Ghost of My Life that made me think more about nostalgia and the uncanny. And I've just been working on the uncanny, which is, I'm still working as an academic every now and then to publish, and this just has come out. And there is a nexus between the uncanny and nostalgia, because Fisher said somewhere in the 90s we got stuck in a loop, and we now sort of mourn, or we're nostalgic for the loss of progress that we felt then even. And you know, that he talks about the future got slowly cancelled, and I think it's an interesting concept, because yes, we are stuck in time. We look back to this loop, and at some point the loop started, or must have started, and you lose interest in the charts of today for whatever reason, and you go back to where you've come from. And the question is that the case for everyone? Is what we hear today in the charts, is that new for the, obviously it's new for the kids, but is that really new, or are we looking at something that's basically using what was there before and just adding bits and pieces and remixes? And do we have new art forms? Are we, or are we not interested because it's just not
you just
as good as it was?
Well, that's right, because you just made me think of something, because I never, sciences were never my sort of thing at school, but I remember in chemistry, you know, when I was 12 or 13 and learning about, you know, the saturation point. And I wonder if it's the same here, because there's a point where it's like a sponge. You take in all of this material, the music, the films, whatever it is, the fashion of the era. Yeah. You know, there's something that is, that you're aware of and you imbibe it. It's not even like, there's no almost like critical distance. It actually is your era. And, and love it or hate it, that's what people are listening to. That's and it's portrayed by the fashions of the time. So it's kind of, you're living in it.
Yeah.
But then there comes a point when, and it happened for me around, I say 1990, when suddenly, like, New Kids on the Block were suddenly all the rage. And I was like, suddenly, somehow, I thought, that doesn't, for me, it's like the baton has you know, passed on. And somehow I wasn't as interested in that. But then my interest in film was kickstarted, because back in the 80s, all of my friends were going to see Ghostbusters or Indiana Jones at the cinema, Back to the Future. I didn't really do any of that, because I do that now with the aplomb. And I'm always thinking of, you know, I had the chance to go and see this in 1989 at the cinema, but I didn't or couldn't for whatever reason, like I had a piano lesson or something, you know. And I look back now, when I watch those films, I'm always like, I wonder if I'd gone with those friends to that cinema in Cardiff, you know, on the high street or whatever, what would be... You know, what would I be thinking? But, you know, it's almost as though I'm watching something now through the lens of
you may have been disappointed, actually, to a certain degree. I think there would have been disappointment, because that's what happens. Not with all the films. If you can transport yourself back emotionally to that age, and to that situation, and swoon the way you swooned about the actors then it's fine for me. But there are films that I loved when I was 12. One of them, don't mention it, maybe cut that. One of them was Top Gun.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, that was the height of the Cold War, really. It was almost a cooling off phase. And now, sadly, we are somehow uncannily going back there again to a certain degree. And at that point, I thought that was the coolest film ever. Tom Cruise was fantastic in his MiG and the Russia. It's a really bad film. I loved it as a teenager because of the cool sunglasses that I saw, and the music, and the Florida sunset. You know, everything that was so crassly American. I really enjoyed that then. When I watch it now, I'm embarrassed.
Yeah.
Almost embarrassed to say that I liked it then.
It's curious, because for me, I saw that. I'm sure it can't be the first time, but I don't have any recollection of seeing the whole film. Only a year ago at the cinema. So that's one of my blind spots. It's one of the films I just never got to watch.
Yeah.
And yet the director, Tony Scott, I've seen like all of his other stuff. And I was actually a bit underwhelmed by it. But this is interesting. There is a new Top Gun film that's coming out. The next few months.
Stay clear of it.
But it's curious. So, you know, you mentioned that at the time it was a great film. You're not so sure about that now. But the fact that there is a new Top Gun movie kind of means that there is that conversation.
Absolutely. Between,
and Tom Cruise, in many respects, doesn't look like he's aged as much as you know, as is humanly normal, you know. So in a funny way, that link between the 80s, when did that come out? 86?
I think it was 86, yeah.
And where we are today, that somehow there is this conversation. And I actually don't know, because the quality proof thing, I almost feel doesn't matter, because the fact that it mattered so much to you at the time that you saw it when you were 12 or whatever it might have been, when the first time you watched it, I don't think that it almost is like such an integral part of your growing up. I don't think you need to worry about the fact that maybe, because that is you. Because how can you go back, you know, and start taking away those layers? Why would you want to? You know, that was the environment in which you
grew up. Absolutely, no, it's absolutely, and I'm saying it half jokingly. I mean, if I was really embarrassed to tell you, I wouldn't have told you.
Yeah.
But going back to these feelings is acknowledging that you've now have a critical you know, you have the ability to critically think about the context, and we've trained in critical thinking, and we've spent so much time being you know, honing those critical skills, and the absence of those skills at that point, that's what's in a way almost heartbreaking to certain point, but also uplifting, because you could go and watch that film and really look at the aesthetics of it and really enjoy these blatant aesthetics of you know, American strength, in fighter jets.
But everything, I think, is, you know, there's nothing that works in a vacuum. I learned this a few years ago, because I remember a colleague I was working with on a book, and it was about theology and film, and she wanted to write a chapter on war and theology, and she focused almost exclusively on the Iraq War, which at the time was only a few years old, and it was, you know, very, very polarizing. And at the time I read it, I thought, this is interesting. I thought, because I agreed with what she was saying, but I also did worry that, you know, that by the time the book came out, or in, you know, 5 or 10 years' time, we were thinking of using it as a textbook, people might sort of feel, well, you know, there's this exclusive focus, and that really circumscribed, you know, when it was written. But then one colleague of mine said at the time, but that applies to everything, you know, that everything was written at a time, and sometimes we're aware of it and we flag it up, but other times we're not aware of it. So it's almost as though whether we put it on the table or whether we're just not, you know, it's just an implicit awareness, or not even that. It's only like subsequently you look back and think, God, I was particularly molded by a particular set of thinking or a particular philosophy of the age, and you realize that, you know, there's nothing you can do about that. So
that's
sometimes
growing.
Yeah, it's also part of our, you know, growing up.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And also it never stops. It never stops. Things that we think now at the age that we're in will probably, or most likely, think differently about when we are our parents' age now, in the 80s. I mean, it never stops, but you know it. And when you think back to your teenage years, you just don't know it, and you don't have to know it. And it's not your job to know it. And it's not a job to act on that. So that's something that I like when I think back.
Do you want to just say something about how you ended up in your profession? You know, so you went to university. Do you want to say a little bit about what you studied?
Well, I studied German and English literature and language. But when I was 15. Age 15 to 18, I actually wanted to become a musician. So I played the guitar, classical guitar, and the recorder, and I did quite well at that age. I played concerts, and I was a soloist in that small place that I grew up in, and I changed my school at the age of, I think I was 17. I was 17, so a year before the A levels, I started the Conservatory of Music, and they accepted me, not in the way and not with that teacher that I would have liked to work with, and I had to start again from scratch. I was quite good in the other school, and I was doing really well, and I got the best parts in the final concerts and stuff. And then I had to start all over again a year before my A-levels. I wasn't allowed to play any music. I just had to do finger exercises, and I was forced to go over the same, to basically, my technique was scrapped and destroyed, and I had to rebuild it. And I was so miffed and so angry about it. Well, I decided not to pursue any musical career. I realized that I would probably have not become, you know, the world's best guitarist anyway. And there was always literature that I was also interested in. So I diverted my energies towards that.
And, do you find, though, that you found other outlets for that passion, or has it sort of resurfaced in other ways? Have you played, you know, musically?
I was singing in the Canterbury Choral Society, as you know, for that was wonderful. That's fantastic, because it's such a it's such a joy to work with professional musicians as an amateur and with a conductor. So I've done that, and I also did a bit of choir singing when I was a student. But I've got my guitar here. It's out. It's there. It can be picked up, and I use it every now and then. But I never really returned to it. So I'm really doing it for fun. And when there are bigger groups together and we do a bit of singing, I like that.
Because if you've got a particular passion for something, what you don't want to do perhaps is find that you are immersing yourself in that through a different sort of lens, for example, an academic one, but suddenly that could in theory, you know, sap you of all of the, you know, the excitement. If you're really passionate about something, but then you suddenly think, oh, I'm studying this now, and maybe actually I'm doing this for a different sort of study, or maybe then you're being assessed on something that actually is almost like primal, you know, it's something that's part of your very being, and yet, you know, you're having to almost compete, and then, you know, you perhaps think, oh, you know, there's this thing that I'm really passionate about, but I'm not doing as well as I want to be, or whatever it might be. So sometimes it's nice to have things that you can just have going on in a different capacity that actually is something like your go-to thing that you can actually do on your own terms, and you don't almost sort of have to have that sort of form of assessment, shall we say, that is
perhaps this is exactly the reason why I'm doing now what I'm doing professionally, because this is an aspect of my new career. I think I'm a new job. I'm not, it's nothing is set in stone. I may still, you know, return to some sort of employment. But what I'm doing now allows me to look into the topics that I like to look into without having to be assessed every 6 years. I can be a researcher. I can use what I've worked on up till now, and I can use my channels and I can use my community and still put it aside if I feel that the time is not right and I have to do something else and want to concentrate on something else, and I can return to it whenever I want to. So it gives me time to still love it, my topic, my research topic. I'm enjoying that greatly. I have to say, it is a freedom that I have not felt in a long time, that I have now. Obviously, I'm also cut off of certain support and infrastructure, and of course, it also has its disadvantages. But the freedom to really think about things and then putting them aside and then coming back to them whenever I want, this lets me enjoy researching more.
Yeah. And do you want to say a little bit more about, we touched on it, about what you're doing now. So do you want to say a little bit more about what your post-lockdown life consists of?
Yes, well, I have started a little company. It's called thinkgerman.at. And I'm a language and culture coach. That means I'm still working with language and text. That's how I started out. I thought that is something that I'm really interested in. I want to stick to working with text. And I want to stick to helping people get an access to my mother language, my mother tongue, through text, through writing, through perfecting their language skills. But I'm also now helping people understanding my culture better. And the good thing is I'm still deep in reverse culture shock at the moment. I've been away for such a long time that I do not know. I recognize I sound like an Austrian. I am an Austrian. I'm back in Austria. But I don't always feel Austrian, and things don't feel natural to me yet. And that's a good thing, because I can use that in my work with expats. I work with people who have come to Austria in search for a job, or probably have a job, working as an academic or some sort of other skilled work in companies, and they work in English most of the time. So I'm using my English on a meta level and work with these people, helping them to arrive in Austria. I teach German still. That's great fun. And because of the pandemic, things have shifted a lot. So I'm doing a lot of online teaching, and I have the freedom to put together as a self-employed person to create programs, create concepts, work with concepts, put them together in a bundle, and then put them out there. So development is ongoing, and I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, and so by the sound of it, you're doing quite a lot of face-to-face, in-person work rather than entirely online.
Lots of it is online. Some of it is in person, and I'm doing group trainings, onboarding. I'm supporting various institutions, public institutions, universities, but also companies with onboarding packages, where I help their employees or soon to be employees, find a footing when they come here first. And that is really it combines what I like to do before, namely helping people and getting helping them to help themselves and find a strategy to move on and do something with what they've been given, and the teaching aspect is still there, because the language teaching I pursue as on another path, it works, and the conceptualization of programs, how to help people past the post pandemic and in a new reality, if we want to use that, help them get to grips with being here.
It sounds amazing, because I'm just thinking that this is it sounds such an obvious fit with who you are but that's what I was thinking. But is this something that you considered doing before you came here, or was this like suddenly we have to find something to do, what can I do? But was this like an accumulation of things that
it's
is now
been going on for a while? It's been in my head for a while. I wanted to communicate Austrian culture in a different way, so that I can actually also help people who need the practical help while they're there. And I'd been thinking about that for a longer time. My mum worked when the Yugoslavia war broke out in the 1990s. My mother, who is originally also studied German and English in Zagreb, so I've done essentially the same thing my mum did. She worked for the state refugee center in the Landesregierung. So basically it was the county government set up a center, and my mother was one of the people who helped set it up so they could deal with the refugees from Yugoslavia in the early 90s. And she stayed there until she retired as a translator every now and then. And she also helped people arrive and get support in her job, and that was in her capacity. She helped a number of people who still recognize her on the streets, who are still around and have made a life in Austria. And when we walk around, there's still people who come up to her and said, well, thank you, how are you, how have you been? And this was the 90s, so they do remember her. And I thought that's just that is a legacy. This is fantastic if you manage to do that, so that people remember you've helped them.
And do you share this with your mother? In other words, do you have this conversation about how it seems to be
I mean,
you used the word uncanny earlier, but uncannily, what you're doing seems to be a continuation of that particular trajectory.
I do. Yes. But I've done when I decided to study English and German, I have several women in my family who did just that. My aunt, my mother, my other aunt, they all had actually basically studied for the same degree. But I thought, OK, I'll take this further, become an academic with it. So I've done that. I'm fine with it now. And now I'm sort of returning to the aspect where I think about how I can use that to really tangibly help someone who will hopefully find it useful and thank me at some point. And I've found that it means a great deal if people come back to you and say, thank you, that was just what I needed. I'm I've had clients who come from very far away who are stranded here, and because of the pandemic, I started in 2020. We did it online. They were not able to go back and visit families, and they were not able to meet anyone outside. So what we did was the only contact they had with anyone in this city. Yeah. They were in their flats. I was in mine, and then we had a German class, but I also explained to them how, you know, public life works once it starts again. And they've already come back already. I can feel, and I heard them say, "This was great. Thank you. That has helped me in rather dark times. And this is brilliant. This is what I want to do."
So do you feel, I mean, this sounds, from what you're telling me, as though obviously it's only something that you've been doing a relatively short amount of time, but it sounds as though all the skills that you had when I knew you, not least actually being senior tutor as well, actually dealing with students in that supported capacity, has actually found its niche. You know, you found a way of bringing all that into your present role.
I hope so. Now I've got to, you know, scale it up a little and find ways to really make a living of it. But it's very rewarding. That's I already can tell that, and it's given me a perspective in times where perspectives are scarce.
Yeah.
But I've got to thank my mother, and I also forgot to thank my father, who was a retired senior civil servant. Very Austrian and very, very traditional in his ways, and very, very, very locally anchored, if that's the word. So I have both in my family. I have my mother, who moved countries and made a new life in the country of her grandmother. So there were some family ties for my mother to Austria. But still, she moved, and she was always curious about going out and seeing new things. And there was my dad, who always made a point in staying in a safe and secure position and making your way up from there.
It's pretty obvious that they are very proud of what you're doing. I mean, it's pretty obvious. Yeah,
I think they believe in me because I've shown them before that I can do it. But but they are a little apprehensive about me leaving all security of an employment and doing something and starting something new. It's a startup, and I'm not 20 anymore, so you know you need to compensate your energies and need to be smart about it.
I'm sure lots of people listening to this will find that really inspiring, because I'm the sort of person who is sort of like, oh, you know, but when you're doing something, you just almost imagine, not so much imagine that you'll do it forever. I'll rephrase that. It's sometimes the case that you're always dealing with the micro level of things. There's always, you know, essays to mark and students to see and curriculum to shape. Totally. And then there comes a point when, you know, you're still doing that same thing. Well, I've been in this present role for 18 years, in the same job for 18 years. So there comes a point when you don't always see the macro level, you don't see the wider picture, and then suddenly you realize that because you've been doing this for so long that you sort of it's ingrained in you, and in my case there was always that dream of doing something on the radio, and
you're doing it,
and it's still, look, exactly,
it's grown. You're doing exactly. It's grown quite a bit. I think you really have got traction there. It's fantastic.
Yeah. It's only when you step back sometimes and you suddenly think, ah, well, actually, it's not what I could have imagined doing 30 years ago, because obviously we didn't have podcasts in those days. Yeah. But it's still, you know, in terms of what's available now, it's actually a complete continuation of that sort of original childhood dream.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think what I've learned in the past is we had to take the step. Once you make a decision, you feel better about it, and then you have to move forward, and you don't have a choice other than moving forward. So you really put everything into it, and then you take it step by step. But there is a world out there, especially if you've been in a role for a long time. And I've never done anything else than working at the university when I finished. There is a world out there, and there are people who are actually interested in what you bring to them from the academic world. We have many more skills than we thought we did.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, yeah. As we were saying earlier, and actually, as we start to wrap up, I was going to, in a way, you've probably already answered this question, but I was going to ask whether your memories are predominantly positive ones.
I think I choose for my memories to be predominantly positive ones, but I thought a little bit more about becoming nostalgic, and I think nostalgia is a bit like a drug, and you can bring it on if you want. You can. And then they are positive, and they can be very moving and very emotive. And then you also have to know how to stop them and how to snap out of it. Otherwise, if you get stuck in thinking back and glorifying the past, which we inevitably do, I think memories are positive because we have positive memories, and this is what you need to do as a human being. You need to hold on to that.
Yeah.
And the negative memories, they become less and less. So yes, they are. My memories are positive. I've had a great childhood. I was very privileged in that respect.
Because I think you raised something really important there about the memories that are maybe not positive, but it's like what we do with them, the filtering out of memories, or the way, I mean, sometimes it can be good, because I mean, I always feel about nostalgia that it's good and bad. It's bitter and sweet. And it perhaps says more about where we are now in our present location than it does perhaps about the past per se, because it's maybe the apprehension that something is incomplete or something's out of alignment, or we want to go back to something that we once had so that we can build it again in the future. So there's lots of the past, lots of the future, lots of the present, all sort of commingling.
I think that's a fantastic last sentence, actually. I couldn't have said it better, but I completely agree with you.
I may have had a bit of practice in the sense that I suppose having done so many of these interviews, and I'm supposed to be writing a book on it at some point, but of course that never quite. Yeah, but I would have said that to you 4 years ago as well.
Yeah, but you have a lot of material now, and I find it's wonderful that you managed to get everyone to get your show.
Yeah.
And demonstrate that everybody has a story, and every person has a story, and has some pride in it to a certain degree when they get to tell the story. So this is I'm going to read the book.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, no. you give me the incentive to start writing it. But I was just thinking as well about this notion of dreams, because we were talking about what you might have thought you were doing when you were young, because it's always a difficult. It's always like the past. You and the, imagining your younger self and your present self in conversation, what would your younger self learn from you now? And what can you learn now from what your younger self imagined they'd be doing in the future?
I'm supposed to say something very wise now, but I think my younger self always wanted to walk around on preferably an English university campus with a lot of books in hand. I wrote the beginning of a fantastically very bad text novelette when I was 16, and the main character was doing just that. So this is what my younger self wanted, and I think I've proved to myself that I can, to a certain degree, do that. Not in the way that I thought it would pan out. I was much older when I finally managed to do it. But I suppose if you want something bad enough, and if you wait, and if you put the work in it, and if you sit out the negative phases, and return to your idea, and you hold on to it, then you'll get to it. It may look completely different than you thought it would, but it works.
Because I'm fascinated now by this novelette that you wrote at the age of 16. So you still have this text?
Yes, but not with me.
No, no.
But I have it somewhere, yes.
Do you think that in some way that's like a template? Because in a way that came true. Because when you mentioned being on an English university and carrying books, that is something that you've done. But is that?
I was thinking of Oxbridge, of course, but sure. The blueprints of Oxford. But
But do you think, but that novel that you wrote when you were young, do you think that that's something that you could, that you would want to do something with? Or is that something you just say, no, that was what I did when I was young? But it sounds to me as though that has actually been, it was your younger self's way of saying, this is my aspiration, or this is what
this is what I want. That was a persona that I liked. No, I wouldn't bring it up anywhere else. But I cherish the persona because I think I've put work in to get to that, as close to that persona as I could. And I've proved that. So now, at least now I know that I can try something else and put my efforts in it. And if it's not what I set out to do in the end, and if it's something else, I've tried it. And that already to me is a win.
and absolutely. And you've put this lovely image in my mind now of having a persona, but also not knowing it's a persona because you're exactly. Living it out and you are the persona, but not in a sort of canny way of thinking, you know, this is the person I'm going to project. I'm going to project this particular image, but you just do it because it's organic and that's what you perhaps strive to be.
So yes, that's the thing.
And my very last question to you, Haida, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm a looking forward kind of person, I think. When I look back, I use nostalgia to make it feel nice, but I think I'm quite firmly on the looking forward page. Otherwise, what is there? I'm a big fan of Matthias Hawkes. You know, he's a future trend. I don't know whether you're aware of him. He's a German researcher of trends and possibilism is what he calls that. Hans Rosling is the other one who was a possibilist, and I quite like the idea of looking to the future and trying to look at us from a future perspective. That helps at least in times like these. And so yeah, I'm firmly on the forward looking side, I hope.
I'm just thinking this has been phenomenal because you this whole sort of intersection between your part, for you, there's something very complete about how you've done many of the things that you set out to do, whether in fiction through the persona that you were writing at the age of 16 or in reality. And then I knew you at the University of Kent, and then you're doing things now which are so obviously a continuation of that journey, and it's been hugely inspirational to catch up. So Haida, thank you for being my guest this week.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's been a pleasure, and it was lovely to talk to you again. And thank you for summing it up in such a way that I can now say, oh, hey, I think I've done the right thing and I've taken the right step. This is really, really nice to hear. This is lovely to hear.